This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 26th of May on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 203 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Steve Bloomfield.
On today's show, we'll be meeting the UK's Labour politician, Alan Johnson, former health secretary, education secretary, even home secretary, but oddly never keen on chasing the Prime Minister's slot. We'll be finding out why.
And we'll be talking to Stephen Kahn, a newspaper man through and through, who's now editing a project dedicated to academic rigour and journalistic flair, The Conversation. We'll be seeing if it's all talk.
And today we'll also be sharing a few stories with novelist and short story writer Ben Fountain. We'll be learning how to turn fact into highly acclaimed fiction.
That's all coming up. Plus, Tom Edwards will be here with this week's news. And I'm sure we'll have time for some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Well, it is me and Steve this week because Mr. Bound has bounded off yet again.
He has to
Los Angeles
yet again.
He says there's a lot of stories there to be done, but I'm not sure. I wonder what's going on. Whether there's a relationship in the budding out there. Who knows? You think
that might be it?
I don't know. No, I trust Mr. Band. I'm sure he's slaving away. He's actually gone to do a nice piece for our quality of life issue, which we're kind of working on now. Which it has to go to press in 1 week.
Yeah. It does, and it's getting there, and it looks quite special. And we've chosen, not that we can say who it is yet, but we've chosen our winner for most livable city.
We've also got the book going out the door, so we've almost finished compiling this giant book that we're doing with Gestalt and the publishers in Berlin. I think it's looking quite good now, actually. But it's one of those things that you have it in front of your face every day until late at night, and you begin to go a bit kind of book blind. But actually,
it's a bit different from doing a magazine as well, isn't it? I mean, it seemed at first as
there's no adverts.
Yeah,
that's a bit I'm missing. They fill up a lot of quite nice space, actually, it turns out.
Yeah, at first you thought, oh well, it's 400 pages. It's fine. We can do that. But it's been big. But it does look very, very good now.
So book, big quality of life issue, people going on tour, and there's also Tom Edwards coming our way.
Keeping you in the loop and on the ball. This is Tom Edwards with his weekly look ahead.
Yes, it's that time of the week where Tom Edwards comes downstairs to tell us what's going to happen in the week ahead. Tom, where are you going to begin this week?
Let's start tomorrow. I've got a few kind of, it's a bit of a business flavour, if you will, this week. Should you like that?
yeah, go on.
To some of these. So tomorrow, an interesting initiative from Walmart in the US, often demonised, of course. But they've got a plan which will be inaugurated tomorrow because it's Memorial Day 2013, to hire... well, as many as 100,000 recently discharged veterans over a five-year period. The idea being that any veteran who, in the first year after they're honourably discharged from military service, from active duty, will find a role at Walmart, the friendly family business. Now, obviously...
That's a lot of people, 100,000.
Over 5 years, yeah. Now, Walmart is, of course, the largest private employer and retailer in the United States. One of the criticisms they face is that they pay people poorly, and they have other issues in terms of, you know, how they look after their employees and some of their sort of general corporate ethics. But I think that's quite an interesting initiative. And as you say, even in a huge organisation of that size, those are pretty big numbers.
And what's interesting, I guess, is that it just doesn't really happen in Europe. That kind of, you know, that fervent belief in the army, that desire to help people, you know, that you do see people walking around in their uniform, that the US soldier is kind of revered in a way and looked after in a way that perhaps hasn't been seen in many European countries for decades. So it's just really interesting. I can't imagine a kind of a British retailer doing that, for example.
No, I think they'd be too concerned about negative sort of blowback in the press, which is interesting that the exact opposite applies in the US. And I think also Walmart is tapping into something. I think there is a sense in the US psyche that they're perhaps, they've failed some of their service personnel. You've got these very worrying figures about suicide rates, mental illness, people, you know, becoming alcoholics, this kind of thing. The trends are going the wrong way in the US still. So I think there's maybe a national sense that something needs to be done.
Tom, the other thing about that then, I wonder if they will have a good program for offering people, you know, advice and support, because it's great to give jobs to all these soldiers. But as you say, many of these people come back from fighting with, you know, with real problems and with real issues that need to be resolved and combat stress. And the idea that they're then kind of shoved into a shop suddenly and asked to kind of start serving people, I hope there's some kind of transition period and some skill on the part of Walmart and kind of judging, you know, who is really ready for these jobs.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the kind of thing you can imagine it could go disastrously wrong. And I'm sure that'll be part of it. And I'm sure that was also a good chance for them to advertise their new improved corporate responsibility by taking care of people.
And in the world of business, anything jollier?
Well, there's a couple of interesting things I thought I'd mention very briefly. Germany and France are launching their New Deal for Europe on Tuesday, echoing, I think it was something that Roosevelt mentioned once about a new deal.
He mentioned something like that, yes.
And I just think it's interesting that you've got governments, you know, employing that kind of rhetoric. Maybe it's a measure of how far the continent fell in 2008. And another thing, which I guess is connected to this in some ways, on Wednesday, the OECD is holding its annual forum in Paris, and tax is one of the big things on the agenda. And it's interesting talking about post-2008 crisis, talking about some of these big international corporations. The OECD want to get more countries to sign up to this special convention they've got, which is to commit to respecting national tax laws, compliance, and taxpayers. They've already got, I think, about over 50 countries have already signed up, and they want to have more signing at this big ceremony, which is happening on Wednesday.
And yet, oddly on this, you hear a lot of politicians say, oh, something must be done on tax. Like David Cameron and George Osborne have spoken a pretty good game on tax havens and cracking down and so on. But you then have this bizarre situation where there are tiny little statelets that are technically that Britain has influence over. And Britain could actually say, no, you should shut these down. Instead, they're reduced to writing letters saying, oh, could you please perhaps think about this?
Well, that's the thing. I think you need to look at the, a more either like a pan-continental or some kind of international thing where people actually sign up and it's formalised, the commitments to either reform the system or at the very least to respect the tenets that we already have. But you sense that maybe businesses, individuals, governments are at something of a crossroads with tax. I don't know, that's the impression I get. It seems to be a hot issue at the moment.
I think there's a kind of, it's an interesting line because, you know, obviously the UK government, François Hollande came into power in France. They were saying, oh, you should move to the UK. We've got, you know, if you're a big investor, you know, we've got lower tax rates. So there you kind of think, well, like, I kind of understand that there's also a kind of fair business game going on there, saying to people, you know, you come here and pay 40% rather than paying 70% or 80%. But it's when you look at corporations who are paying nothing or half of a 1%.
Because they've managed to take their profits from one country, send it to their operations in another country, then bring it back in the double Dutch or the double Irish.
Yeah, and then it becomes ludicrous because then you hear all this kind of debate about, you know, how these kind of tech companies are so successful and, you know, this is the future. Well, I'm sure if lots of newspapers were given tax-free exemptions, you know, then they'd be just as successful as well. You know, so old media is there kind of paying its taxes at the end of the day. And there's these kind of new media operators who are just very clever at kind of dodging paying any taxes in any countries because the nature of their business is so international. Then suddenly you think, well, actually, this doesn't make any sense. This is a very unlevel playing field.
Well,
that's my bit.
No, absolutely. I think it's a very good point. Let's see who signs up, Andrew, on Wednesday, if anyone.
I'll sign.
I'm not sure that will be binding
on
the entire
whom?
British nation.
Oh, okay.
And finally, go on, have you got something else for the,
okay,
towards
we'll
the end of the week?
I'll give you one fun one. How about on Saturday? Do you know what's happening?
No.
This is one of my favourites. It's World Milk Day.
Really?
Do you want to know what happens?
Do we all drink milk?
We celebrate all aspects of milk.
All aspects? What are the aspects?
But that's, guys, why I've brought you these beautiful lattes each to celebrate milk together.
Oh,
enjoy drinking those here.
And you're going to have a bath. You could have a milk bath.
I'm going to have a milk bath. I often model myself I like to take, you know, themes from the classics and from antiquity in my personal life.
I've now got an image of Tom Edwards taking a milk bath.
It is acid. It's acid's milk, of course.
Oh, God, that's not a good note to end on.
You keep your ass to yourself. Now, that was Tom Edwards looking ahead at the news. And thank you very much indeed.
There is nothing unusual about a political memoir. In fact, it's often surprising when veteran politicians elect not to consign their recollections of life in government to the printed page. The former Labour Home Secretary Alan Johnson, who served under British Prime Ministers Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, is the latest to enter the fray.
But Johnson's book is very different from so many of those that precede it. For starters, his is not a story of an eminent career fashioned in the traditional British political proving grounds of public school and university. far from it. It's a tale of struggle, often against great odds. And secondly, it begins and ends long before Johnson's rather unlikely rise to prominence in Westminster. Earlier, Steve spoke to Alan about how his formative years shaped both his political career and his enduring attitude towards social justice.
Alan Johnson, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. This book is... it's an unusual memoir for a politician because it's not about your time in office. It's not about trying to explain the decisions you've taken. In a sense, it's the sort of memoir that a politician might do before they start a career because it says, this is who I am.
Yeah, and perhaps a few more of us should do that. But I think the problem is finding the time. When the public relieved me of ministerial office, I'd been a minister for 11 years and it leaves a big chunk in your life, and so you do this day job as an MP. But that's when I started to think about a book. I discounted the political memoir because lots of people will be doing their account of the Blair Brown years, and I had some diaries that I've kept since I was in my 20s. There was a publisher very interested in those, but I think what I really wanted to do was to tell that story of what I think two remarkable women, my mother and my sister, and to try and kind of make my mother live again on the page. I think anyone who's lost a parent when they're very young or lost a loved one, to have the opportunity to try and recreate them for the reader, opportunity too good to miss. So that's what my publisher decided would be the best route, and I thought he was right.
It's incredibly unflinching in terms of the way you tell this story, and it's large parts of it are uplifting. It's a difficult read at times, isn't it? Because this was not an easy way to grow up.
No. Dear old John Rental in The Independent, in the course of a very lovely review, said it's the saddest book he's ever read. I don't want that really to be the strap line. You know, read this book and you'll end up in tears. Because, as you say, I hope there are uplifting things in it. But it's difficult to tell my mother's story without it being sad. Sad when she was a girl. She was one of 10 children. Two of her siblings died in infancy. Very common then, measles followed by pneumonia. There are no immunisation then. And a dictatorial, quite brutal father. She escaped all that to come to London during the war and then married the wrong guy, my dad, Steve. Always had this heart condition. Her mother died at 42 of cervical cancer. Her mother's mother died at 42. And my mother, Lily, was convinced she was going to die at 42, and she did. But maybe she wouldn't have done if she hadn't have been doing all the scrubbing and cleaning jobs that she had to do to bring some money in. There was no alternative for her, but that obviously, you know, it was against doctor's advice, and I think it helped to make her life much shorter.
You mentioned that. I mean, one of the things you talk about in the book is how we have this view of 1950s Britain that women were housewives and stayed at home, and they just looked after the home, and the men were the breadwinners who went out to get a job. But that certainly wasn't the case in your community and certainly in your home.
It wasn't a case amongst working class communities, or not in the working class communities where I was. Yeah, this image of a kind of peaceful innocence in the 50s was far from the truth. In many ways, a very brutal life that people led. A community spirit, and there were things about it that perhaps we have lost in a more sophisticated age, yes. But I think on the whole, we are so much better off today than we were then. And in a way, this touches on, it's not a political book, but it touches on a political issue, because I think one of the main attractions of parties like UKIP is a kind of nostalgia for a world that was. You could smoke where you like, you could call people what you wanted to call them, you could live a life of kind of isolation in the British Empire or whatever. I doubt if that was the case ever, but it certainly wasn't my experience of the 50s. So I try and puncture some of that in the book.
There is a danger, isn't there, that you can... yes, isn't quite get quite nostalgic about that time.
Yeah, because, you know, everyone gets nostalgic about the past. There was always a better age. But, you know, wherever you look, whether it's music, whether it's the way women were treated, whether it's the way ethnic minorities were treated, the disabled were treated, you know, called spastics and shouted at and derided. The way the environment was, you know, I talk about the fogs, the great smogs that hit London. All of that has been improved, and all of it's been improved in a way that some people, as I say, it's not a political book, but, you know, some people hark back to a better age and say, oh, it's all interference, elf and safety and all this. But actually, a lot of that was about making people's lives more civilized and making them happier.
When, and correct me if this anecdote is completely wrong, but there's a story about Tony Blair, when you were a minister in his government, hearing your story about how you were brought up mainly, of course, then also by your older sister, how you'd had three kids by the age of 20. Mm. And he goes, oh, blimey, you really are working class, aren't you?
Yeah, it's a shame that story's been used against Tony. I've got a great deal of affection and admiration for Tony. But, yeah, it was one Christmas and little Leo was running around. I've got a son the same age as Leo. And he said to me, and I happened to say I've had three kids by the time I was 20. And Tony said, oh, gosh, you really are working class. And I said, Tony, if we procreated on that basis, we really would have a population problem. But for Tony, the thing was, and this is where I, you know, leaped to his defence, it was inconceivable to him that anyone that he knew or from his background would ever have left school at 15 or have a family by the time they were 20. You know, it'd be unusual to leave school at that age, whereas in my community, it was unusual to stay on. It'd be unusual not to go to university. In fact, practically unheard of in kind of Tony's circles. University might have been planet Pluto for us. So, you know, I think what Tony generally wanted to do, what he was amplifying there was the fact that this seemed so strange to him for a kid to be married, virtually a kid at 20 with three kids. And, you know, I do think a lot of what he tried to do, whether it was education maintenance allowance, whether it was Sure Start centres, was about giving kids the background so you did give them a better opportunity, the same opportunity as people from his background would have to stay on at school as if it was perfectly normal to go to university.
We're living in a time now where arguably the three most important politicians in Britain not just went to the same university but all went to the same school. And yet, you know, 20 years ago we had a Prime Minister, John Major, who was from Brixton, who was a grammar school boy, who would rail against the rich kids in his own party, saying these people have never had the problem of running out of money at the end of the week. Do you think there's a danger that this current generation of politicians don't really quite understand what poverty means?
Well, I do think, I mean, there's snobbery and there's inverted snobbery. So you shouldn't hold it against someone for their, because they had a more privileged background. They were as little in control of that as I was. So you want to see talent coming through. I think what concerns me and many others is this treadmill into politics now that's become the same on kind of all sides of the house. You come and be an unpaid intern, and that's because your parents can afford to put you up and give you a few bob. You go on to university, you study PPE, usually you get a degree in PPE, then you come as a special advisor, and then you seek a seat, and then you're a minister. And there's kind of nothing in between, a little bit of poncing around at a television company or whatever. And I think that is a shame because, you know, the post-war generation, when I started voting, you know, it was still that post-war generation. Most of them had been in the war, been in the army, seen a lot of life. I wouldn't want it to happen that way, certainly in a world war, but they'd done things and they'd achieved things, and it would have been very unusual, leaving aside William Pitt being Prime Minister at 24, but that was when you virtually flagged out and died at 36. So in the modern age, there was much more diversity in terms of people's occupation, and we've started to address some of the balance about a lack of diversity in gender and in race in the House of Commons, though we haven't gone far enough. But lack of diversity in terms of social class and what you did outside of Parliament, I think is something that worries people. And I think Tory Party is a good example of this. It went through this phase, Ted Heath, Margaret Thatcher, John Major, where it looked like they'd broken free of a kind of old Etonian or old Harrovian treadmill into these positions. And now it looks like we've actually gone back a generation in that sense.
When you look at your own political career, are you disappointed you didn't rise further, or do you look at this and think, look, I was Home Secretary, I was Health Secretary, I was a Cabinet Minister for several years, and look at where I started?
Well, I don't look so much at look at where I started, but I'm very satisfied. I did five Cabinet positions, finished up as Home Secretary. I never have a minute's regret about not going rising any higher than that.
Did you want to be Prime Minister?
No, not a burning ambition. There was a time, as I've related recently, when we were talking about a possible coalition with the Lib Dems after the hung Parliament in 2010, where the condition would have been that Gordon would have to step down, but he knew that anyway. He'd lost an election. No one won it, but we'd definitely lost it. And we were talking about a three-year coalition to get through the difficult period in terms of the world economic problems. And I thought I'd throw my hat into the ring for leadership Labour Party in those circumstances to do a specific job. I certainly didn't think it was the time for the younger generation to kind of throw themselves on those particular cannons or in front of those cannons. but the moment passed. But that's the only time I've ever seriously considered that.
Was there not another time, though, when on one of the various different plots or suggested plots against Gordon Brown where you thought about it, you went for a walk up Victoria Street?
Yeah. God, you've done your research. That was the time when Hazel Blears resigned, Caroline Flint resigned, James Purnell was about to resign.
So this was the European elections, 2009.
Yeah, that's right, 2009. We'd had a terrible, terrible drubbing. We'd had a drubbing in the local government elections as well. Everything seemed to be going against us. It looked like Gordon might be forced out. And actually, I sat at PMQs on the Wednesday and thought I might be doing this next week because, it's going to go to one of the main offices of state. I was regarded as a contender. The cabinet would have made the decision prior to the members deciding. That's what happens when a prime minister steps down. A member of the cabinet steps forward. But I decided, having walked up and down Victoria Street, that I needed to give Gordon my support. I felt it would have been pretty treacherous to have stabbed him in the back, quite frankly. For all his lack of perfection that he would admit himself, he was doing a great job on the world stage. You know, when Lehman Brothers and the financial collapse around the country, it wasn't Hank Paulson in America that was calling the shots. It was Gordon, and the G20 followed him. Obama and several Nobel Prize-winning economists have said that Gordon's role was crucial. And while he's dealing with all that, coping with that, with Alistair Darling and others, it would have been, I think, pretty treacherous to kind of stab him in the back.
I want to ask you about politics at the moment, and particularly the way that the welfare state in the UK, which has been around since the Second World War, which has been pretty much agreed on certainly for 30, 40 years after the Second World War, has been chipped away somewhat at times over the last 30 years, but particularly right now, whether that's the talk of there being strivers and shirkers, which sort of to some people brings back the idea of the deserving and the undeserving poor. When you hear cases that are hyped up in certain newspapers as being somehow emblematic of what the welfare state is like, what's your take on that?
Two aspects of this. The first aspect is, there needed to be reform of the welfare state, and we carried out a lot of reforms, not least of all because we had the highest percentage of lone parents on benefits than anywhere in Europe, and part of that was an absence of proper childcare facilities. Part of that was you could claim benefits up until your child was 16. You know, the untold story of our years, the way that it's tried to be portrayed by this government, is that we just handed benefits out. Actually, we did a lot to deal with that incapacity benefit, where people were pushed out of the steelworks and the coal mines and the shipyards and encouraged to go on to incapacity benefit to keep the unemployment statistics down. So the numbers went from 700,000 in 79 to 2.6 million when we came into government in 97. These were people told to go away and be the passive recipients of benefits for the rest of their lives. That did need to be tackled. These people did need to be helped to get a route back into work because generally, I believe, I don't think there's much disagreement, that having a job is part of your dignity. That's why we're called the Labour Party. It'd be strange to believe that and then believe that you should somehow be defending being told to go away and live on benefits. That aspect of it has that welfare reform. And in a sense, that did spiral. Incapacity benefit definitely spiraled, needed to be tackled. Then there's the second issue, though, is this rhetoric, which I find absolutely disgraceful. I mean, it's not, pick my words carefully, but I think that politicians like George Osborne ought to be ashamed of the rhetoric they're using. You know, shirkers and workers. Number two, Arcacia Avenue, they're going out to work at 6 o'clock in the morning and they're looking up at their neighbour who's closed the curtains, sleeping off a life on benefits. That's what Osborne said. That is such a mischaracterisation of what happens on benefits. For a start, the person going off to work at 6 o'clock is probably going to clean an office and they're on such low pay that they're on benefits. And there are very few, there are some, but a tiny amount. I knew when I was at Work and Pensions who are, living in a string vest and smoking the fags and living this life on benefits. Very, very few. Most people want a hand to get into a job. There was a job advertised in Hull last week for a cleaner in a care home, an adult social care home. Not a good job, a very tough job, on minimum wage. One job, 160 applicants. These are all people who are supposed to be shirkers wanting to get into work, even difficult work at low pay. So I think this rhetoric is divisive, and I think something that's as divisive like that in our society is really pernicious, and it does lead it can influence people to turn against people on benefits as if they're somehow the losers in life and, you know, not worthy of any help or assistance. And that would be a terrible shame. That would take us back, 200, 300 years.
That was Alan Johnson in conversation with Steve about his childhood memoir, This Boy, which is published by Bantam Press. We're going to take a break for some music now. This is new from that easy on the ear South Carolina producer, Toro y Moi, with Never Better.
That was Toro y Moi with Never Better. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Andrew Tuck. We'll be having a conversation next.
Whether you're in the midst of a busy business day in Europe or eating your cereal on the East Coast, The Briefing sets you up with a fast-paced mix of news and views that you won't find anywhere else.
It's a very beautiful phone, I think. It's not out till next month. That's the only phone outside of HTC at this moment.
This one I'm holding?
Yes.
No wonder we've got security.
We'll bring you the latest developments in aviation, technology, defense, retail, and media with our industry experts, a rundown of the US and Latin American papers, plus a sharp business review of the day.
It really came about with us saying, you know, this would make sense to do something that we would enjoy shopping at and kind of change the retail landscape a little bit.
So tune in to The Briefing every day at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York.
And you're back with The Weekly. The challenge of launching a newspaper in today's marketplace is a bold move for anyone, be it a printed daily battling the onslaught of free online content, or simply a slightly more sophisticated online edition looking to capture the internet's fickle attention span.
But The Conversation, a new media service offering daily digestible comment and opinion from some of the world's top academic minds, is attempting the latter. And we're joined now by editor of The Conversation, Stephen Kahn, to hear what they're talking about. Stephen, welcome to the show. So let's just get a few basic things out of the way. Is it an online newspaper? Is it a media service? How do you see yourself? Is it a newspaper, first of all?
I wouldn't describe it as a newspaper. I think you summed it up perfectly. It is a news analysis and comment service produced by some of the world's finest minds. We pair those academics up with a team of journalists, some of whom are based at City University in London. We also have a base in Melbourne, Australia. That's our headquarters. And these people work together to produce content that is topical, analytical, and provides comment on some of the events and discoveries that are shaping the world we live in at the moment.
Now, it started in Australia 2 years ago. Just tell me what the remit is of the UK version. So are you attempting to look at the European landscape? Is it politics? Is it business? What kinds of topics do you look at?
We are indeed looking at the European landscape and really tapping into the incredibly diverse and in-depth expertise that's available in the UK's universities, but across the continent as well. We are looking at politics, yes, but also at science, environment, health, the key issues that are, as I say, shaping today's social and political landscape. But also, science is hugely important for us. There was a sense, I think, that's probably felt within the scientific community quite acutely, that science and scientific research perhaps wasn't getting the airing it might in the mainstream media, and we see ourselves as an outlet for some of that scientific thought, research and expertise.
And now, two of the biggest problems that all media face at the moment is who is going to pay for it and how do you fund it? And so talk us through how you're funded, because you know, it's quite an unusual way of doing this, isn't it?
Well, we're funded by the university sector in the UK, which is at the moment a six-month pilot project. We have the backing of 13 universities and then also the Higher Education Funding Council. So these organisations have put in money to set the project up. There is also investment from some research bodies essentially that's what's allowed us to launch in the UK. It's a similar but slightly different model to that which got the project off the ground and has seen it flourish in Australia.
And tell me, what's the gap that you and the universities see? Do they feel that the mainstream media don't cover science well, don't cover politics well? We have a huge number of newspapers already in this country, many of whom have online presences. We have, you know, the likes of the Huffington Post launching European versions of their website. What's the gap that you see that you want to explore?
Well, we really feel that we can expand the market. We felt that there's loads of comment out there online, of course, some of it very good. But what we felt was there was a rich pool of people who were genuinely qualified to comment. These are real experts in their field. It was felt that not enough of these people were necessarily breaking through into the mainstream in a sense that they weren't necessarily being heard by the public. So we feel that we've got a role to play in tapping into that expertise and giving the public access to the smartest analysis and comment that is available.
And when you look at, you know, how newspapers are doing, certainly in the UK at the moment, I mean, your background is newspapers. You've been working for 20 years or longer?
A bit less than that, Steve.
Okay, a while though.
15 maybe.
Yeah, okay, we'll give you 15. Up in Scotland and down here in London at The Independent and at The Guardian in particular. How have you seen those newsrooms change over those 15 years in terms of the amount of expertise there really is in a whole wide range of different subjects?
I don't think it's any secret that the investment in news products has been declining almost for the entire period of my career, particularly, I think, areas with specialist reporters. We've already talked about science a bit, but there are areas such as health, education, environment, which obviously becomes more and more important. These are areas which have suffered to some extent over the past decade or so as money has been taken out of a lot of news products in an attempt to maintain profits or keep them alive. Now, I'm not saying we replace entirely what these organisations have done, but we'd certainly provide another outlet for coverage of some of these areas. As I said before, we're primarily news analysis and comment. Basically, what we are is tapping into specialist knowledge at a time when that knowledge and the outlets for that knowledge are possibly somewhat less than they were a number of years ago.
And Stephen, tell us how this whole story began. So it begins in Australia. Was it a group of academics who began this project? Who was the person who had the idea in the first place?
Well, the project's very much the brainchild of Andrew Jaspin, who's a former editor of The Observer here in London and had been in Australia editing the Age newspaper in Melbourne. And he, along with a team of people, started the project there. And as I say, it's been hugely successful in Australia.
And when you look at what's happened in Australia, I think the thing I found interesting about it is it's not just, you know, people coming to your website to read comment pieces there, but that you're making it available for free for other newspapers, other online blogs or so on to actually use that content. So you were finding in Australia a lot of smaller rural newspapers were picking up these comment pieces and running them as their own.
That's right. A lot of news organisations, blogs and other sorts of websites have seen the wealth of knowledge that's available in the content and have reproduced it. And that's something we're very keen to encourage. It's at the heart of our mission statement that we're about expanding knowledge and taking that knowledge to a much wider audience. This is obviously a key way of achieving that aim.
I was just going to say, what's the tone of the pieces you publish? Because, you know, the world of academia can be a little bit kind of, you know, I'm just dealing with a project at the moment where if they send me one more paper about what they've done, or even their own biographies can kind of send you to sleep if you're not careful. That's the problem sometimes with academics is, you know, that, yeah, they've got really smart ideas, but once they start trying to translate that into something that ordinary people can read, they get horribly lost and they just cannot give up on that kind of language that pulls everything down to a kind of a deadening pace. Do you find that a challenge when you're going into the academic sector to say to people, look, yeah, you may know more about science than anybody else, but hold on, I need to give you a bit of advice here. This isn't the way to tell a story.
Well, yeah, one of the great things about the conversation...
He says smiling. there was a smile on your face there. I think that's a conversation you've had a couple of times.
Well, it's a question of being asked a couple of times. But, one of the great things about the project is that we do have a team of 8 editors who are very experienced, based here in London, and twice as many in Melbourne. They have been engaging with academics and working with them to ensure that the content is topical, readable, accessible. It's, you know, as I said, it's at the heart of the project to make this knowledge and this material accessible to as wide a group of people as possible. So we're all about unlocking the door to this knowledge and making it readable and engaging.
And just finally, it's interesting looking at the very recent example this week with the events in Woolwich. We've had a lot of, every newspaper, every media organisation has tried to find an interesting angle on it, their take, something to add to it. You know, the stuff that I've read on the conversation has been, it's been historical analysis of images of violence. It's been looking at, things that happened 50 years ago. It's giving a very sort of different take to what you found in most of the mainstream media. Has, what's happened over the past few days since then, has that sort of for you been quite a useful experiment in what the conversation can do that's different from mainstream media?
Absolutely. For the conversation in the UK, this is our first breaking news story and it's right on our doorstep. One of the things that people say is that, academics can't write, they can't write in the style of journalism, they won't write quickly. But I think, already we've proved that that's not the case. We had content up at 9 p.m. last night. Thanks to our Australian wing, we had a second piece online during the night in the UK. And you're right, these pieces provided a different take. It was analytical and to a degree historical. I think that people will welcome that. I think that people are looking for different takes on the news around us. I'm confident that they'll find that in the conversation.
Stephen Kahn, editor of The Conversation here in the UK. Thank you very much indeed and best of luck.
Thank you.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental. It does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian, the shows that do well run and the ones that don't close. And there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well. It has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's A Review, every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly.
The old saying, don't let facts get in the way of a good story, is something we try to avoid, obviously, here at Monocle. But storytelling itself, whether it's news reporting or a great novel, is a skill that's vital to pulling any reader into the action.
US novelist and short story writer Ben Fountain is master of turning the everyday into prize-winning prose. His books, Brief Encounters with Che Guevara and Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, have been recipients of the Penn Hemingway Award for Short Stories and the National Book Critics Circle Award, two of the highest honours for writing in the US, for their portrayal of environments ranging from the slums of Haiti to the story of a US soldier returning home from Iraq. He joins us now to tell us where fact meets fiction. Thank you very much for coming in to see us, Ben.
Thank you.
I wanted to pick up with your own history a little bit before we dive into these two amazing books. Every biography I've read about you, every interview, picks up on this fact that it was a long journey for you to go from being a lawyer to becoming a writer, an 18-year gap between you first starting to do it. And I believe you're in your 50s now, and this is your first novel out. Why did it take such a long journey?
I think part of it is it just takes me a while to figure things out. And And I wish I was smarter, but apparently I'm not as smart as I wish I was. And also I was doing it largely on my own. I didn't get a master's in fine arts and writing. I didn't have a writing group. Sometimes I wonder if I would have developed faster if I'd been in a community, the right kind of community, writers or readers who are smart and open-minded, of generous spirit. But basically everything I learned on my own or from the reading I did.
But do you feel you would have, if you had done that, you would have turned into a different kind of writer?
That's the question. And so you wonder if all those false paths you went down, if they were necessary steps in ultimately getting to where you get to. So I don't worry about it. It is what it is. You know, I just, every day I get up and try to get the words on the page.
Now, we'll talk about Billy Lynn in a moment, but your first huge success was a book of short stories which are based on which are true stories. So how did this journey come to then again switch over from fact to fiction? Did your publisher say to you, you know, you've had with Brief Encounters with Che Guevara a huge success, but now I need a novel from you. This is the next step in your career. And was that something, or was it something you felt, actually, I'm now ready for this challenge?
Well, you know, I'll confess right here that I have two or three novels in the drawer that never saw the light of day, and that's fun. But I really wanted to write a novel and get a novel published, a novel that I was happy with. And I don't think I would have been satisfied with, you know, my writing career, if a career is what you want to call it, if I hadn't done this, written a novel that I was pleased with and got published. So it was me. I mean, it's not anything coming from the outside. This whole writing project has been really from the inside out.
You say you're fine with the fact that you have two or three novels in a drawer. Are you really? I mean, do you? Because it's one of the things about writing is people say, lots of writers say, well, I write for myself first and foremost, and that's what's most important. And if anyone else likes it, then that's just a bonus. But surely you're writing because you feel you have something to say and you want other people to hear it.
Right. When I say I'm fine with those novels in the drawer, you're right. Actually, I'm not. but I'm okay with the fact that they didn't get published because they simply weren't good enough. That's an interesting issue you bring up. I think on one level, you do have to write for yourself. You have to please yourself. I think part of the job is getting published. That's part of the writer's job. And Ezra Pound once made the comparison to a scout. Okay, there's a tribe. The tribe sends a scout out to, you know, reconnoiter the territory. And the scout sees what he sees and comes back and reports to the tribe. And he said that's what writers do. They go out, they survey the human condition, they come back to the tribe and report. And I think that's a pretty good analogy to what writers, most writers, are doing.
Now let's dip into the new book, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, which is a story which looks at what happens to a group of soldiers returning to the US from Iraq, and especially to the main character, to Billy. When you began writing this book, were you concerned to tell the stories of soldiers? Was it a critique of war? Because what seems to be at the heart of a lot of it is actually a very kind of uncomfortable relationship between the American public, who on the one hand do lionize these men and have huge faith in them, and the rather different story for the people coming home and how they try to navigate their way back into this this world that seems suddenly a little bit alien.
I'm sure what I wanted to explore in this book, and it began as a very vague thing, but the tremendous disconnect between the reality of the war as it's experienced by the young men and women who fight it, and the reality of the war as it's perceived by mainstream American culture, which is basically a fantasy. And that's what I wanted to explore, this huge gap, and why the war was perceived in such, to me, a false and misleading way in the United States, when I think it didn't take much awareness or curiosity to discover that much of the mainstream narrative that we were being given in those years was completely false.
I was just going to jump in. One of the other filters that seems to be between the men and the public and the telling of their story, you insert the world of Hollywood. Are you critical of how Hollywood has shown American fighting men over the last kind of 10, 15 years during this incredible period? You know, we've had the movies about Afghanistan, the Iraq movies. Do you feel that these have done a disservice to the men coming home?
Well, I haven't seen a lot of those movies. I've seen The Valley of Eli, and that was a really fun movie. I think they got into some real things about what soldiers experience and the fact that that when they come home, they're different people. They've been through something that very few of us can understand. I saw the documentary Restrepo, and that was a wonderful piece of work. But I haven't seen The Hurt Locker, or I can't call to mind any other movies I've seen.
There's a theme, so obviously not just running through your book, through lots of the literature and films about not just this war, but other wars as well, as you've just mentioned, of how people feel when they come back. And there's that always that difficulty that people here have when a family member has come back from war, how they help deal with it. Films like, you know, Stop Loss, Flags of Our Father, looking at the so-called heroes from Japan. Were those the sorts of things you were trying to bring out in Billy Lynn's, in that idea of what a hero is and what that heroism means when they actually try to come home?
I was trying to write the story from the inside out. I had the notion of these characters in my head, Billy first and foremost. And I thought, if I write it authentically, line by line, that these larger themes and inquiries and explorations will find their way to the surface, hopefully in a meaningful way. So I started with this small group of American soldiers who have been through that ultimate reality of combat. And then they come home and they find themselves in this surreal, you know, patently insane situation of being guest of honor at a Dallas Cowboys halftime show. So, I mean, soldiers coming home or not being able to find their way home, that's one of the oldest stories in the world. That's the story of the Odyssey, a group of soldiers trying to find their way home from a war, and they can't find their way home. And ultimately, only one soldier makes his way home, and when he gets there, nobody recognizes him.
Can I ask you, you know, you come from Texas, we can hear that in your voice, a very patriotic state, a state which is, you know, known around the world as somebody, you know, who's very supportive of America's position in the world. But you're writing a very kind of a liberal, almost leftist novel in some places. How do those two worlds come together in your book? And yeah, how do you meld them in the way that you're sitting in this slightly conservative state in some ways, and you have this book that's quite critical about U.S. politics and about the world and about how you treat soldiers?
Well, I mean, I live in Dallas, Texas. I live in North Dallas, which is an extremely conservative place. I'm in the same voting precinct as George and Laura Bush. I think it's a great place for a writer to live in. In some ways, you're in the belly of the beast. And if I was a liberal living in Berkeley, California or Austin, Texas, it would be really easy because I'd be hanging out with people who agree with me. Living in North Texas, North Dallas, my assumptions, my worldviews are always being challenged, either overtly or just by virtue of the culture, you know, the air I breathe, the culture I live in. So, you know, my assumptions are always being tested, and that's fine. I think that's a good way for a writer to live.
That's the second time you've sort of invoked this idea that you're somewhat of an outsider. Is that something you feel strongly and that adds something to your writing?
I think in American culture, if you set out to do what's hopefully some kind of genuine or authentic art, you're by definition going to be an outsider because you are defining yourself in terms other than economic terms, in terms other than the amount of money you make and the amount of money you spend. And so I think just by definition in this day and age, if you're going to try to be an artist in the U.S., you're an outsider.
And can I ask you perhaps finally, how many Billy Lynns did you meet in the writing of this book?
Quite a few. And the average age of the U.S. soldier in these wars has been 19. And in some ways, those young men, and in some cases women, are so young. And in other ways, they seem so ancient.
Ben, a remarkable story, and thank you for coming to speak to us. That's Ben Fountain, and his book, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, is out now in good bookshops. Well, that's the end of our conversation, almost. I really enjoyed Ben Fountain coming in. And it's interesting, Steve, I guess that kind of how you tell the story of Iraq even today, you know, that, you know, is it told best through the photography? Is it told best through films? Is it told best through fiction or fact? You need all of these elements to really kind of get over this extraordinary event that we're still only beginning to understand the repercussions of, I guess.
Well, indeed. And what's interesting, I find, is how relatively quickly a lot of this literature and a lot of the films have been produced. If you know, think back to Vietnam, it was, you know, Platoon was the first big film about Vietnam, which was 88, something like that. I mean, it was a long time after that people started to look back, and already, as you said, you know, mentioned the film about Osama bin Laden, made a year and a half after he was killed. There's a remarkably quick turnaround. But this is certainly a book that's going to last the ages, as I believe will Alan Johnson's memoir, This Boy, which is, as a political memoir, I mean, obviously it's not a typical political memoir, as we were talking about earlier. It is beautifully written and tells you so much about, you know, the man who became the politician.
No, he sounded extraordinary. It was funny in the week. He's one of those characters, if you're British, you kind of know so well from the television, from seeing him in debates. And I came downstairs and he was kind of just sitting there in the lounge waiting downstairs to come on the radio. I was like, oh my God, what's he doing here?
Exactly.
But, yeah, but good.
And that's it, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's all for this week. We will be back next week. But that's it for edition 203 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Jack Phillips, and our researcher was Audrey Letendar. And we'll be here at the same time next week. But until then, from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Steve Bloomfield.
It's time to say goodbye.
Goodbye.